Line Washington, Thursday, June 4th, 2009. Hello again from the nation's capital. I'm Greg Corumbus. In this edition, Obama gives the speech. We'll speak with Ilan Berman, Vice President for Policy at the American Foreign Policy Council and author of the upcoming book, Winning the Long War, and get his reaction to the president's outreach to the Muslim community, his thoughts on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and whether this was the latest stop on the Obama apology tour for previous U.S. policies. Also in this edition, Dunce Cap and Trade. Jim Manzi of the Manhattan Institute with us to run the numbers on what the actual impact of the cap and trade legislation will be. Plus, the real cost of health care reform. President Obama says his brand of reform will actually save the economy and the taxpayer money. Sally Pipes, Vice Chairman of the Pacific Research Institute, is with us to say, oh no, it won't. And Tiananmen Square plus 20 years. We'll reflect on the crackdown against the student protests and talk about where China stands today with Walter Lohman of the Heritage Foundation. All that plus the top news is straight ahead on Dateline Washington. We begin with the Obama speech to the Muslim world, and we begin right now. My first guest in this edition is Ilan Berman, Vice President for Policy at the American Foreign Policy Council here in Washington. He's also the author of the forthcoming book, due out later this month, Winning the Long War, Retaking the Offensive Against Radical Islam. Obviously, today we want to get his reaction to President Obama's speech and his latest outreach to the Muslim world delivered at the University of Cairo. And Ilan, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, good to be back.
This was obviously one of the most highly anticipated speeches, certainly the most of this visit had been leading the headlines in most media outlets around the world for days, even before we had any clue what he was going to say. What do you make of what he said? Was it too specific, not specific enough? What were your immediate takeaways?
Well, I think it was all of those things. There were parts that were very specific and frankly, very needed with regard to burnishing America's image in the Muslim world. And there were other parts that were infuriatingly vague and perhaps misleading. And, you know, the president talked about essentially seven things, from the need for an Israeli-Palestinian settlement to dealing with Iran to economic opportunity. And the way he portrayed American policy ranged from an outright rejection of his predecessor's policies and this idea of being a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more in tune with the grievances of the Muslim world, to comments about, for example, human rights and liberty and opportunity in the Muslim world that sounded a great deal like President Bush sounded in his first term when he talked about the fact that these values are not simply Western values, these are universal values. So in all, I think the message was both very different from the message the Bush administration sent to the Muslim world, but in many cases it was very reminiscent.
Let's talk about the highlights and the lowlights here, Ilan. What do you believe the president did well in improving America's image, or at least trying to, in the Muslim world?
Well, I think one of the most important things that the president did was actually his conversation about 9/11 and about the ongoing fight against radical Islam and radical Islamic ideology. There's been a great deal of speculation, both abroad and here in the United States, that Obama's willingness to turn the page in relations with the Muslim world would essentially mean that America has given up the ghost when it comes to the fight against al-Qaeda and it comes to the fight against radical extremist groups. And, you know, he unequivocally said that this was not the case. He spent a great deal of time emphasizing the depth of the atrocity perpetrated on 9/11 and the justification behind an ongoing campaign, and he emphasized it was ongoing, with regard to rooting out extremist groups like al-Qaeda. This was, I think, a very welcome comment, and it was one that his administration, because it's made such a dramatic change in attitude towards Iraq, for example, and Iran, it really needed to be to reinforce that there was also going to be a great deal of continuity in terms of how it approached the Middle East.
And then you said a moment ago, Ilan, that other parts were misleading and vague. What specifically do you believe he missed the ball on here?
Well, I think in particular on Iran, there was a great deal to be disappointed about. The president talked, I think, at length about the fact that Iran is entitled to be a nuclear power and to acquire nuclear power. And this is actually the topic of a fair amount of debate in the United States. And this is misleading in and of itself because this really wasn't the Obama administration's to grant. Iran became a signatory to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty in 1979. 1970. So the cat's been out of the bag for some time. It's almost a done deal that Iran is going to become a nuclear power, or at least is entitled to become a nuclear power. What he could have done better would be to emphasize that the nature of the threat posed by Iran doesn't emanate from Iran's attempts to acquire this technology, but rather from the fact that Iran is ruled by a radical regime that has connections to terrorists and that simply won't be a responsible stakeholder when it acquires this technology. So when it comes to Iran, it looks for all the world like American policy is all about process. It's not really about substance. We're more concerned with benchmarks and technological verification than we are with who's going to ultimately have the finger on the trigger. And this, I think, should be worrying for a lot of people who are watching, who live in Iran's immediate neighborhood, because they are concerned about this regime acquiring this technology.
Ilan, another major issue the president mentioned, the Israeli-Palestinian standoff and the efforts that he wants towards a two-state solution. Some were taken aback by the fact that the president said that on the one hand, the Jewish population suffered through the Holocaust, and he seemed to equate that with the 60 years the Palestinians have been waiting for a state of their own. How did that strike you?
Well, no, I think that certainly could have been worded better. I don't think that was the showstopper. What I think I would have liked to see in regard to his discussion of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is if he were actually to acknowledge that there's not one Palestinian Authority right now, but there's two. There's the Palestinian Authority that's ruled by Mahmoud Abbas, the titular president, which is ensconced in the West Bank. And these are the people who we are trying to have the Israelis broker a peace with. And then there is the Gaza Strip, which is a separate, non-contiguous landmass, which is also part of the Palestinian Authority, but it's ruled by Hamas, which is a radical rejectionist Islamist movement, which is committed to the destruction of Israel. So it's not quite enough to say we want Israel and the Palestinians to make peace. We need to be specific. We need to be able to articulate very clearly, both to Israel and to the Palestinian Authority government, that we're willing to help them eradicate these radical rejectionist movements. And the president simply didn't talk about that.
President Obama also reiterating his belief that no more Israeli settlements should be constructed in the West Bank. He's been very firm about that on numerous occasions. The Netanyahu government in Israel has been resistant to that. What kind of dynamic do you see between these two leaders going forward?
Well, it's very clear that the U.S. and Israeli relationship is undergoing a fair amount of change, and probably not for the better. President Obama and Prime Minister Netanyahu have very strong personalities, and I don't think their inaugural meeting, when it took place about a week and a half ago, was very auspicious, in particular because Obama made clear very early on that he had some very definite ideas about how Israel should conduct its policies, including, in particular, this idea of stopping settlement growth. And this is actually, I think, a far deeper problem than the White House talks about, because the president, I believe, and certainly Secretary Clinton, have been on record as saying that there should be no growth at all in the settlements, no population growth at all, which is actually fairly problematic because there are Israeli citizens who live there who are having children. So this is essentially a demographic time bomb because, is the United States saying that if you are an Israeli and you live in settlements and you have a child, you are no longer entitled to live there? This is kind of micromanaging that's going to be very, very counterproductive.
Some feared that this would be another speech in which the president continued his apology tour. We saw it a little bit with his references to colonialism and how Muslim nations were treated during the Cold War. Do you believe that was a continuation of this so-called apology tour, or appropriate given the setting?
Well, I think it was both. There certainly was a great deal of apologia that was sort of proffered by the president. He talked a great deal about these sort of grievances, and at least in my estimation, I'm not sure that that's necessarily the most constructive thing to do, would be to dwell and repeat and rehash some of the sort of the myths, and even if they're historically accurate, the sort of the tropes that are bandied about on the Arab street and on the Muslim street, because he certainly is not in a position to reverse American participation in the 1953 coup in Iran, for example, or anything like that. And so it's useful to acknowledge as a historical event, but it's not necessarily useful to dwell on them. And so I think whether or not it's an apology tour matters a great deal on what constructive he proposes to do. And this speech, for all of its very flowery language, was the president's an excellent orator, and the scope of the speech was really masterful in terms of the amount of ground that it covered, but it was very short on actual proposals of moving the U.S.-Muslim relationship forward. The most striking thing in my mind was this absence of action items. It's certainly a good opening salvo, but if the president really wants this to be more than an apology tour, he has to talk about concrete things that he's going to ask Muslim governments to do, that he's going to offer to do in exchange, to really change the tenor of the relationship in a lasting way. And he hasn't done that so far. It's been a great deal of atmospherics and not that much substance.
Last 30 seconds, Ilan, do you expect this one speech to make much difference in the Muslim world, and does his family history make much impact?
The family history, I believe, certainly does. And he's traded more heavily on that in the run-up to this speech than certainly they needed during the campaign, in which it was very impolitic to even mention the president's middle name.
Right.
But the speech itself, if this is a one-off event, if there is no follow-through, if there's no real commitment to building bridges to the Muslim world, is not going to make much of a difference. And if the administration is planning to be serious and to reconfigure the way the U.S. relates to the Muslim world, which is a very laudable goal, it will also have to be a little bit more sophisticated than it's been so far, because the president in his speech equated 1.4, 1.5 billion Muslims with essentially being a world community. This is not one unified mass. There are different countries, there are different governments, there are different perspectives, there are different regions of the world. And so it's not enough to say that we want a new relationship. It's a series of relationships, and we have to set about trying to define them and define them in a way that promotes American security.
Ilan, unfortunately, our time is up. As always, sir, thank you so much for your time and your analysis.
Oh, my pleasure.
Ilan Berman is the Vice President for Policy at the American Foreign Policy Council. Again, his book coming out later this month, Winning the Long War, Retaking the Offensive Against Radical Islam. This is Dateline Washington.